Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark, and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me on Let Us Be Frank About It. Lucy, a slightly shonky line.
Hello. If I cut out at points within the podcast, it's not because I'm not 100% invested in what's going on. It's because I have got a little bit of a connectivity problem, I think, today.
I like to feel that listeners know this is how it's real and authentic and deeply felt, and we don't let tiny things like microphones put us off. Hello, Lucy. I should say welcome back. You've been away.
I have been away. It's very nice to be back. I see you manage brilliantly without me.
Well, we managed, but we'd never say brilliantly. And I see, or rather hear, that you have been gallivanting around and going to gardens.
I did go to one garden, one great garden, world famous, I think, which I had never been to, reprehensibly. I went to Great Dixter, Christopher Lloyd's garden, which I'd read all about, but never actually seen. And it was a beautiful, beautiful day. And I was knocked out by it. It's magic. Have you been?
I've never been, and I'd love to. Must go.
Well, let's try and wangle it so that we can do an episode of Turning Leaves at Great Dixter. We'll sit in the garden and talk about books. How about that?
I think it'd be a great dereliction of duty if we didn't do it from there. Let's do that. Did you read a lot on your holiday?
I didn't read as much as, not that much is my honest answer. I mean, because I read quite a lot, you know, at work, sometimes I don't always, or I don't read the same sort of thing necessarily. Anyway, I'm chuntering. What I did read, I read a bit of science fiction, catching up on the old science fiction, on a Hugo and Nebula Award winner that I hadn't been aware of, a writer called Martha Wells. And it struck me that, because this series of books is told from the point of view of a robot, sort of robot, mostly, well, all robot, but they're clearly acquiring feelings and things like that and working out what to do with them. And I was just struck by the sophistication of the level of kind of thought and feeling and narrative and all ramifications, all those sorts of things that you've get in science fiction that you've had for years now, actually. And you know, on the news, when you hear about AI, it's just sort of people shrieking about they're going to take over the world, or is my toaster going to attack me, you know, that kind of thing. And you would think that nobody knew anything about it or had thought anything about it other than...
Because nobody's asked the science fiction writers.
They've been exploring this so brilliantly for so many years. At the moment, there's a crop of, I would say from about Anne Leckie onwards, there's a crop of brilliant, brilliant women who are writing things about stuff from the point of view of, you know, it's either from the point of view, it's a ship with distributed intelligence and then it loses most of its distribution packets. And how does it feel having a single point of intelligence, a bit like a human? How do they make relationships? There's a whole fascinating thing about gender, because if you have an android or a bot or whatever, they can have no gender. They can not care about it. They can choose a gender. Do you know what I mean? There's so many fascinating byways and explorations. I mean, thought experiments. They're thought experiments, as are all novels, I suppose. But these ones in particular. So I think, you know, I don't know. I just feel that we should remember that people have been writing and thinking about this for a long time, and they're writing brilliant stuff right now. So, you know, get out there and
well,
read a bit of SF.
You've kind of inspired me to do that, because these are not writers who I'm very aware of. And I suppose when I've experienced things like AI in fiction, it's been through novels like Machines Like Me by Ian McEwan or Kazuo Ishiguro's Clara and the Sun. You know, those more recent kind of novels where people are exploring artificial intelligence and its intersection with human dynamic and human relationships. Lucy, I'm going to ask you now, do you think it's very bad of me when I read about this thing, which I believe is called ChatGPT, or it could be GTP, I'm not sure. And GPT. I think GPT, I don't know what that stands for.
No, I don't either. Absolutely no idea.
It seems to be able to write things. I think, well, could it write my book reviews if I'm very short of time?
Don't say that to me.
Oh, no.
I'm the wrong person to ask that question. Can we just say we would like all of our reviewers to actually write their reviews themselves, please? That's official. I'm going to say that's an official TLS line. We'll run it through our plagiarizer, our ChatGPT sensitizer.
Right, without further ado, because I feel I'm getting myself into, you know, zone of unemployment here. Coming up on this week's show, Boyd Tonkin has been to see Complicité's stage adaptation of Olga Tokarczuk's Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead. And Barnaby Phillips goes in search of the source of the Nile.
But first, you may remember that last December we talked to Simon McBurney, the artistic director of the theatre company Complicité. And one of the things we talked about was the forthcoming production of Complicité's imagining of Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead, the novel by Olga Tokarczuk. Tokarczuk won the Nobel Prize in 2018 for what the committee called a narrative imagination that with encyclopedic passion represents the crossing of boundaries as a form of life, which is a pretty good description of her work to hand it to the committee. So, how to bring an intensely literary and complex book to life on stage? Well, Boyd Tonkin went along to see the show for us and wrote us a lovely piece, and we're delighted that he's here to talk about it with us. Boyd, many thanks for joining us.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks.
So the way they brought the book to life, you talk about, you make a very interesting point about their methods as a company and how that works with literary texts. So it might seem unexpected. Can you explain that for us?
Yes. Well, of course, Complicité are now 40 years old. They started in 1983. And in their early days, there was a lot of rather too simplistic talk, for my taste, about how they were challenging all the kind of text-based obsessions of British theatre. In other words, they were a company rooted in mime, in movement, in total theatre, if you like, in a multi-sensory experience. And so the proponents of this approach said, on the other hand, you had rather kind of stiff, wooden, old school British actors just declaiming lines in a way that felt a bit like, I don't know, the Stratford in the 1950s. And to my mind, this was always a bit of a false binary, because Complicité, they were rooted in a mime tradition. They had studied with Jacques Lecoq in Paris. But on the other hand, they were also very, very literary. They chose really interesting literary works in order to bring them to the stage. For instance, The Street of Crocodiles by the amazing sort of proto-surrealist Polish writer Bruno Schulz, or Haruki Murakami, The Elephant Vanishes, or even Bulgakov, The Master and Margarita. And what they did was not just adaptation. It wasn't kind of gutting a novel and turning it into a script. It was more like a complete envisioning of what that novel might or story might be like on stage. And in a strange way, I think this makes them not less literary, but more literary, in that they are, if you like, trying to tap in the total imaginative experience of undergoing the process of reading a novel. So I think the kind of text versus movement dichotomy is a bit misleading in relation to their work.
That's really fascinating, because obviously, as you've illustrated, it depends a lot on the selection of the work. I mean, they need to choose something that's really going to lend itself to that kind of total immersion. But it also, in a way, that dichotomy, that false binary, as you call it, precludes the idea that literature itself is a multi-sensory experience, that actually reading is, and works often bring in all sorts of other senses, not just the sort of eye-brain connection.
Well, of course, this is really fascinating because, as you know, there's physiological research that suggests that reading a book when you're totally immersed in it is closer to actually experiencing what the book describes than, for instance, watching a movie or a TV show. And I think that the complete bath of experience that you get with Complicité is more like being a good reader than it is with, to just sitting in the stalls and letting a straightforward adaptation flow over you.
Well, you're right. Immersed is the word. When you're immersed in a book, you're in its world. That's what we say, isn't it? You feel like you're in the world of the book. And I guess that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to put you in a world. But it's a fascinating idea, because actually that false binary that you name is around quite a lot. That's kind of what that is, I think, what people assume, that because it's physical theatre, it can't also be, you know, interested in text or narrative or, you know, kind of literature. So what about this production then? How did they translate it to the stage? I got the idea from your piece that and from what you say, it's a very holistic thing.
It's very holistic, but it's also built around the monologue of Tokarczuk's central character, Janina Dusheko, who's a kind of 60-something eccentric living in the woods in the Polish countryside near the Czech border. The novel is her soliloquy, and remarkably, the production is her soliloquy as well. She's there on stage from beginning to end. Sometimes she breaks off to act in separate scenes, but she always comes back to this direct address to the audience. So that in itself is an unashamedly literary way of mounting a stage production.
There's also, it's a very strong voice, and it's very singular. I mean, I was trying to think of a word for it, for singular. I mean, it's quite weird, isn't it? It's quite a weird narrative. It's quite an odd voice, the way she talks.
Well, she is, she's very much her own person.
Yes, and, that's a better way of putting it, yes.
And she's both very wise and very eccentric. And the way this happens on the page is that she uses, or rather Tokarczuk uses, capital letters a lot. And this gives an emphasis, a flavour, a rhythm to the monologue. And of course, you can't do that on stage. But what you can do is to convey in the voice the degree of idiosyncrasy in the way that Janina tells her story. This, I think, Amanda Hadding did with incredible prowess and commitment. And also, this sort of offbeat humour that runs all the way through the book and all the way through the show.
When you say the capital letters, that she sometimes puts things in capital letters, that also for me was a very Blakean, that was part of the Blakean strand of it. His spirit and some of his lines run throughout the book. Did they get him in as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, the book is in many ways a sort of a constant homage to William Blake, whom Janina translates and reads and almost worships as the sort of apostle of the respect for nature and respect for all living creatures, which is what she upholds and espouses. So you not only get Janina quoting Blake, but you get Blake couplets emblazoned over the set as kind of massive surtitles. The work in particular that runs through the whole book is The Auguries of Innocence, with its prophetic warnings of what will happen if you disrespect the natural world.
It's about all sorts of things, the book, isn't it? But animals and their rights, or their lack of rights, the lack of rights that humans give to them, are integral to the story, aren't they? How are they brought alive or evoked on stage?
Well, here we're back to something that Complicité have always done with massive delight and skill, which is to impersonate animals, to bring them to life through the movement of human actors. And they do this brilliantly. There's a wonderful dog, there are lots of deer, there are birds. And if you like, this isn't just a party piece, although it is hugely virtuosic. It's also a proof of what Tokarczuk believes, of what Janina believes, that all life is interrelated, that in a way, different forms of life will repeat mimic each other, that we don't exist in separate domains. We're all part of the great wheel of nature, and we should respect every other spoke on that wheel.
You did say that it was a bit binary when we're talking about the humans. It's kind of nice versus nasty. Does that get more complex, or is that kind of the way it is?
The book unfolds as a kind of fable, and it's an ecological fable. It's a feminist fable, and fables demand a fairly clear contrast between light and dark. And you certainly get that in the characters, that Janina has her friends and her enemies. Her friends are mavericks and oddballs and outsiders, people who don't quite fit into conventional society. And her enemies, which are very, very funny in the way they're portrayed, are, if you like, the small town bigwigs of this area of the Polish Highlands, the policeman, the priest, the head of the mushroom picker society, the guy who runs a really nasty, exploitative fox fur farm, who also, as we learn, exploits human beings as well. So there is the sense of a fairly clear division, but it's occasionally complicated. There is a character who's the wife of the local politician, the mushroom picker's president. And we see how she suffers, if you like, by not being able to live her own life, by being entirely the creature of other people's expectations, whereas Janina and a band of misfits have chosen freedom and, in a way, enjoy themselves much more as a result.
That idea of the sort of fabula, I mean, it goes hand in hand with a kind of timelessness, a sort of, I don't know, I suppose a kind of ahistoricity in the prose. And I wonder how that came across in the stage production, whether it felt like it was something almost out of place, out of time, divorced from the world beyond this kind of area and divorced from the time as well.
That's really interesting, because I think you're right. There is this fairy tale quality in the staging. It's very dark. We follow the life of the Polish forest through the year. It's often shrouded in gloom with the stars whirling overhead. There's fantastically expressive video work by Dick Straker, and the set by Ray Smith has this great sense of twilight gloom. And of course, we're in the forest, and it is a fairy tale forest. It's a place where unlikely and outlandish things happen. It's a place where good and evil will clash, and where truth will be revealed. And all of that slightly timeless fabula quality is very much conveyed by the complicity staging, I think.
As a fable, it's quite a dark fable, isn't it?
Well, I think you have to take Olga Tokarczuk seriously. She's not striking a pose. She's not putting on an act. Her rage at the kind of exploitation of nature, and with it, the exploitation of people, especially women, that Janina expresses, is very deep-rooted and is a key to her work. And of course, it has made her a fairly controversial figure in Poland, because she does go against tradition. She does upset the hunters and the believers and the rural conservatives. They don't think of her simply as a charming eccentric. She has real enemies. And I think the darkness of her vision in the book and in this production does come through. She's deadly serious about the damage that people do to the planets and to their fellow creatures. And I don't think we're ever allowed to forget that.
This is what struck me before. There's a phrase, I think it's Janina, it was one of her kind of, I think she's talking to somebody else, she's trying to convince them. And she kind of talks through the horrors of the amount of death and destruction that goes on every day to the animals, and talks about, you know, carrying bags made of skin. You know, and she's talking about, you know, kind of handbags and leather shoes and things like that. But the way she talks about it is so deeply felt, and actually does strikes horror into you, doesn't it? And as you say, you think Tokarczuk and presumably Complicity are saying, well, it should strike horror into you.
Yes, yeah. And it, for me, it's impossible to read the book and see the show without thinking about the other great Polish-born literary supporter of animal rights, the Yiddish writer Isaac Bashevis Singer. And when Singer in the 60s wrote that for the animals, it is an eternal Treblinka, people were outraged. They said, Mr. Singer, how can you say this? And he said, I am deadly serious. I've never been more serious about anything. Obviously, Tokarczuk has, I think, inherited some of that.
I must say, one of the things that occurred to me on reading your piece, which was just so interesting, was whether anyone might dare to take on her next work, The Books of Jacob, which, of course, is enormous, yeah, and a historical epic and a picaresque and many different stories in one huge book. I guess it's, would we think that could ever come to the stage?
Well, I think if anyone could do it, maybe Complicité could. They've managed to work their magic on the most unlikely source texts, and I don't think sheer length has ever deterred them, so who knows?
Who knows?
Boyd, many thanks for talking to us today. And I know that we've been talking about a London theatre production, which, of course, most people can't get to. But Drive Your Plough will be touring until June. And if you can't get to the theatre, it will be broadcast on the 27th, 28th and 29th of April while it's on at the Lowry in Salford. Still to come on the show, we travel back in time in the company of two Victorian explorers. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark. In 1857, two British adventurers set off from Zanzibar in search of what we're told in Candice Millard's new book was still the holy grail of exploration, the source of the Nile. They were John Hanning Speke and Richard Burton, and to put it mildly, they didn't get on. Indeed, they were still arguing over the truth of who had found what so bitterly that the Royal Geographic Society organised a debate to settle the question long after they'd come back. It never happened because after all his daring exploits, Speke managed to fatally shoot himself on a hunting trip in Wiltshire the day beforehand. One result is that over a century and a half later, the books about their expeditions keep on coming. Barnaby Phillips has reviewed Millard's River of the Gods in this week's paper and joins us now. Welcome, Barnaby.
Thank you, Alex.
Now, set the scene for us. Back in 1857, these two men, very different indeed, decide to go on a perilous journey together. Why did they? What did they hope to find? And why was it so important to them to find it?
I think they were both driven by a personal sense of adventure and a desire, perhaps more in the case of John Hanning Speke, for glory. And if you like, vindication in the eyes of the British establishment. I think John Hanning Speke is a much more conventional figure, prim and puritanical, Candice Millard calls him, from an aristocratic background, an army officer, someone who loves to shoot big game wherever he goes. And Richard Burton is a much more complex, intriguing figure, British in name only, Candice Millard calls him. A polyglot, I think he speaks 29 languages, a career of extraordinary variety. He's made his way to Mecca in disguise. He's translated the Kama Sutra. He's an atheist. He scandalizes Victorian society, but Victorian society also falls for him. He's pursued by beautiful women. He's a very interesting, unique character, and as Candice Millard says, it is the Holy Grail, the source of the Nile. For those who know the geography, of course, the African Nile has two tributaries. There's the Blue Nile, which comes out of the Abyssinian Highlands. Well, people have known that, Europeans have known that since the 17th century, but Europeans have not known where the White Nile, the greater southern branch, they meet at Khartoum, where that comes from. And all efforts to go down the River Nile have ended in the great swamps of what is today South Sudan. So it is a great mystery, and the two men are driven on.
So they weren't the first. People had sort of foundered in this swamp territory, and it had become something that everybody worth their salt wanted to discover. But why did they team up if they were so very different and presumably in some way in competition with one another?
they were put together by the Royal Geographical Society, and it was an ill-fated partnership. In fact, the signs had already been there on an earlier unhappy expedition where they'd crossed from Aden into what eventually became British Somaliland. So if you like, the Horn of Africa, the tip of Africa, that ended disastrously. They went back to Britain, not getting on terribly well. The Speke went off to the Crimean War. The omens were not good when they gathered the second time down in Zanzibar, deciding to go further down the coast and move across from there, which was the right idea. As you said, those who tried to go upriver all the way up the Nile had floundered in the swamps. So it was the right idea, but things quickly went wrong. They were very incompatible. I'd say, in fact, maybe the only thing they did have in common was their extraordinary physical courage and endurance, because they kept going for month after month after month on foot, attacked by wild animals, often so sick and diseased that they had to pause for weeks on end. Malaria, we would assume, typhoid. At one point, a beetle crawls up Speke's ear and he gouges it out with a penknife, and his whole face is covered in boils. He loses his sight at one point, he goes deaf, and yet somehow they stagger on and on. Tragically, they are more and more contemptuous of each other the further the expedition goes. But the real enmity comes after the return, when Speke claims the glory and says that he has discovered the source of the Nile, and Burton is bitter and furious at what he sees as a betrayal.
I mean, I'm no doctor or indeed explorer, but gouging out a beetle with a penknife, it's not going to go well.
And parts of it do continue to come out of his ear, if you really want that detail.
I do, actually. Not. Go on.
Yeah, parts of it do come out with wax many months later.
Wow. Yes, quite. It sounds almost like a sort of ripping yarn, the idea that they basically already hated each other and had already been on an expedition which hadn't gone well, and they just kind of gritted their teeth and gouged the beetles out of their ears and carried on. And was it that Burton thought that Speke had taken the glory of it, or they disagreed about the actual source, about where they thought it originated from?
It was both. What happened was that Burton had to stop three quarters of the way across what is today Tanzania. They had already been to Lake Tanganyika, which is on the very western side of Tanzania, and Burton had believed that this would be the source of the Nile. They realised that it wasn't. Burton was too sick to carry on, and Speke carried on to the lake, which he christened Lake Victoria. An interesting difference, by the way, a telling difference of that. Their personalities was that Burton thought it was absurd to name a lake in the middle of Africa after a British queen, but Speke was keen to do so. Speke instantly decided, more or less correctly, as it were, that Lake Victoria, the Lake Nyanza, it was called by the people who lived around it, was the source of the White Nile, although he had not yet travelled round to the northern part of the lake, where the White Nile does indeed flow out of. He comes back to England, makes his announcement, and returns for a subsequent expedition without Burton and with a much more pliant companion, a man called James Grant, who's never gonna question Speke's primacy in that second expedition, if you see what I mean. He accepts that Speke is very much in charge. And on that second expedition, they do find where the Nile does indeed flow out of the northern part of what we now call Lake Victoria, an enormous lake.
But had they really found the source then? Or was it just somewhere where it came in? Or is it actually much more complicated than that?
Well, that's a good question, Alex. You can go to a place called Burundi, which is to the southwest of Lake Victoria, and you can go to a little village and you can find a place called Sauce du Nil today, which neither Speke nor Burton went near. And so if you accept that there are large rivers flowing into Lake Victoria, and they originate in those highlands to the west and the southwest of Lake Victoria, you may well argue that they are the real source of the Nile. Mm. Likewise, the famous mountains of the moon, the mythical mountains, the Ruwenzori's, where rivers flow across Uganda from there and meet up with the Nile at a later point. So it's not clear cut, but I think you can make out a good case that Lake Victoria is it's definitely one of the most important sources of the Nile. And to that extent, Speke was right and Burton was wrong.
But it's that thing, isn't it, of conquest. I mean, it's just inextricably linked with that idea of finding something, naming it, and in a sense, claiming it, when the truth might be rather more topographically, geographically, nationally complicated than that. But it was also linked with the idea of doing it for the glory of empire. I mean, I presume that's why you would indeed call a lake Victoria. It was a sort of gift to the Queen back home.
Yes, and definitely Speke is more motivated in that way than Burton. I mean, this is an age of exploration that is happening at a certain time, and we are looking back at it at a certain time that is not sympathetic to the values of that time, if you like. And I think that's something important to say about Candace Millard's book, that she draws a link between the age of exploration and the scramble for Africa, which comes immediately afterwards. And she sees Speke as an early imperialist. I think she tries to rectify that by introducing a third protagonist who is on the cover of her book, who is Sidi Mubarak Bombay, who is a guide who goes with Speke and Burton on their expedition, and who is an enigmatic figure who is lauded by both of them in their journals, in their diaries. They have many kind words for him. He's clearly terribly important to them. He's given a silver medal. He's given a pension for life by the British government. And Candace Millard makes out a good case that in his own way, he was a more important explorer than either of them, because he carries on being used, if I can use that word, by subsequent British explorers. When Stanley reunites with David Livingstone, a decade and a half later, well, Mubarak is Stanley's guide. When a man called Cameron, who's the first European man to ever walk from the east to the west of Africa, in the 1870s. Well, again, Sidi Mubarak is by his side. In total, Candace Millard thinks he might have walked some 6,000 miles. But frustratingly, he doesn't have a voice. We have to try and divine his motives through, for example, Speke's observations of him.
And did they credit him at all in the literature of the time? And when they returned from their expeditions and were giving talks and writing up reports and all this sort of thing, was he known in any way?
Well, he certainly didn't enjoy the popular acclaim of people like Speke or Burton. But I don't think he was ignored. As I say, he was given a pension for life. He was given a medal. Now, from the perspective of 2023, that doesn't seem particularly generous, and it seems tokenistic and, I suppose, crudely imperialistic. He is written out of history, and Candace Millard has done her best to bring him back into history. So certainly, you know, within exploring circles, it was known that he was an extremely important man to have on your side. Once you got to Zanzibar, you wanted to recruit him, you wanted to pay him well. But what is really going through his mind? I mean, there's one extraordinary moment when they're camping near Lake Victoria / Nyanza, and Speke wants to press on. Sidi Mubarak thinks this is a bad idea because a local guide hasn't turned up. And Speke punches him three times in the face till the blood flows down his face. And Mubarak walks away, vows never to explore with speak again. But he relents. A few hours later, he joins him. And we only have Speak's description of that event. What was Sidi Mubarak thinking at that moment? What was he generally thinking in these years in which he led these white explorers into the heart of Africa? And we don't really know. I mean, by fortunate coincidence, when I was reading Candace Millard's book, at the same time, I was reading the book Paradise by Abdul Razak Gurnah, who won the Nobel laureate of martyrdom. It was a complete coincidence because he is also describing an expedition across Tanganyika. Admittedly, some 30 years later, the Germans have already arrived, so it is a German colony. But things haven't changed that much. You know, there's still slave trading and there's still these great, great caravans into the interior. And that's a fictional account, obviously, but a wonderful, haunting fictional account of a boy who's on that caravan. And I'd suggest to listeners that if you want to get close to the minds of people like Sidi Mubarak, or indeed the hundreds of other porters, guides, all the rest of it, translators who are on these expeditions, because please don't think that Burton and Speke and Stanley and Livingstone are wandering around by themselves, then Abdul Razak Gurnah's Paradise is a good place to go. I should say as well, his own life is extraordinary. He's called Sidi Mubarak Bombay because he was enslaved as a boy and taken the Arab slave trade across the Indian Ocean. That is the other slave trade, and lives in Mumbai, I think for some 20 years until his master dies, and then he's allowed to come back, and he comes back to Africa. But he'd not been from the island of Zanzibar before. He was actually from, for those who know the geography, some way south of the borders of what is today Mozambique and Tanzania. So his own life is an extraordinary odyssey, I suppose, of tragedy and adventure and challenge. So full credit to Candace Millard for elevating him up there with Burton and Speke and putting him on the cover. And I don't think, I don't think we can hold it against her that he is bound to remain an enigmatic figure, unfortunately.
I was fascinated by the afterlives. I mean, expeditionary and great, great discovery afterlives are often more interesting in a way once you get past the beetles and the swamps and the rest of it. But they come back and they continue to fight. And in the end, they just decide to have a sort of showdown, I think.
That's right. They're going to meet in Bath. Well, in fact, they physically see each other the day before the great debate. And it's, metaphorically daggers drawn, Burton with that great intense stare of his. And then Speke goes off for a bit of hunting, and he stumbles, preparing for the forthcoming verbal duel with Burton. And he stumbles over a wall and shoots himself in the stomach. Now, inevitably, the speculation, was this a dramatic, tragic suicide moments before or on the eve of this epic showdown? And Candace Millard plays with that idea quite a lot. I think other historians have given that idea shorter shrift. Candace Millard's argument is that Speke knew so much about guns. Indeed, he did. He was obsessed with shooting whatever he saw, wherever he went. And that he was also very well known for being very cautious with his guns. He always made sure if he was on a canoe that the barrel was not pointing towards him and all the rest of him. So how could he have been so stupid as to shoot himself in the stomach? And perhaps he really did mean to. I think other historians have written about these two figures and their rivalry. I'm thinking of Tim Geale in particular, who wrote a book that came out some 10, 15 years ago, have said, well, if he was really going to commit suicide, would he have done it stumbling over a wall? That seems unlikely. Burton, meanwhile, carries on. I mean, he at, he carries on to further adventures. He's sent off to Fernando Po, the island off the West African coast, and he becomes a consul there, responsible for the emergent British Empire on the West African coast, having done all of this exploring on the East African coast, having been across Arabia and all the rest of it before that.
And this is where he intersects with your specialist subject, Benin, isn't it?
It is, Alex, yes. In 1862, Burton goes to the Kingdom of Benin in the interior of what is today Nigeria and becomes the first British official to be greeted at the court there. And Burton is trying to stand up for the interests of British palm oil traders who are working on the rivers there. But he comes back and he writes a very caustic account of Benin. He calls it a place that stinks of death, and he describes all the human sacrifice. And that is important because in 1897, just 3 decades later, that idea of Benin as a city of blood is very, very strong in the British consciousness. And it helps provide the justification for the British punitive expeditions sacking of Benin, which leads to these objects, the Benin bronzes, these fabulous objects being looted, plundered, and being brought back to Britain, which is a story I've researched in my own book, Loot Britain and the Benin Bronzes. So there's a link between Richard Burton and the subsequent invasion. Richard Burton's damning indictment of Benin helped create the moral climate, if you like, that enabled the British to invade Benin some decades later.
And this is, I mean, as I understand it, and your knowledge will dwarf mine by a magnitude of many millions, I'm sure, but it had maintained its independence, Benin, up until that point, hadn't it?
Yes. I mean, this is the tragedy from the point of view of the people of the Benin Empire, also known as the Edo. They had been a powerful West African empire who had engaged peacefully with successive waves of European explorers, adventurers, of whom Richard Burton was one of the very last, since the late 15th century. So they'd got on pretty well with the Portuguese, who'd been coming back for centuries, then the Dutch, then the French, then eventually the British. And initially, that relationship with the British is harmonious. But by the mid-19th century, attitudes in Britain have hardened. The British, having been enthusiastic slavers, are now very much against the slave trade. There is a greater sense of moral superiority, a greater sense of racial superiority, a greater religious zeal. And although Richard Burton is not a typical British imperialist, his condemnation of Benin is fuel to those British interests who do want to get rid of the Benin Empire by the late 19th century.
Do you think he was aware of that? Because the way, as we were sort of talking about it earlier, and Speke seems this much more sort of, as it were, kind of off the peg imperialist who we thoroughly disapprove of his attitudes. But as you were describing it, Burton is the far more, he's a polyglot, he's an enthusiast, he doesn't seem to be quite such a clear-cut example of the imperialist, but then he turns out to be precisely that. Was he aware of that, do you think?
I think he's really complex, Alex. I think there's a temptation to see him in modern terms, maybe as a more sympathetic, broad-minded person. But I think that going down that route is a little bit anachronistic, actually. I think,
yes, it's a naive approach, I'm sure.
Exactly. Candace Millard says something really interesting about him, actually. He studied every religion and he respected none. And so he was as contemptuous as the aristocratic British families with which he engaged, in fact, which he married into, to the horror of his mother-in-law, as he was of the African kingdoms who he denigrated. So he's very hard to to pin down, let alone to sort of position in today's culture wars, if you follow me.
Well, listen, Candice Millard's book does sound like it's sort of joining a body of literature that helps us understand a little bit more of that. We're kind of running out of time, but I can't possibly let you go without asking you about elephants.
Oh, thanks, Alex. Well,
it's important, right?
It is important.
What you work in is a sort of Pan-African organisation for the protection and conservation of elephants. Is that right?
That's right. And what I find particularly interesting, one of the many things I find fascinating about elephants, is that they still exist in the wild in 36 African countries. So people think of elephants and they think of, you know, Kenya, Botswana, South Africa. They don't think of Liberia, Eritrea, Senegal, Nigeria, Mali. It's these countries which I find particularly interesting. They make up the majority of the elephants' range, and yet in the majority of these 36 countries, there are less than 1,000 elephants surviving. And so that range across Africa is on the verge of collapse, if you like. And the most, well, people always ask me, oh, are elephants about to become extinct? And the short answer is no, they're not. Elephants will survive, I'm sure, hopefully for decades, in a handful of well-managed game parks in East and Southern Africa, which may well be fenced in, which may well be little more than glorified zoos. The challenge is, are they going to survive in any way that resembles how they have survived in Africa for millennia across a much greater range? Can they survive in countries which have no wildlife tourism at all? Can they survive in countries where there are tiny fragments of rainforest left? I'm thinking of a country like Côte d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, where there's just a few hundred elephants in tiny patches of forest. Can they survive in a country like Nigeria with its breakneck demographic growth? Those are the critical questions for elephant conservation.
Barnaby, thank you so much for coming to talk to us about Benin, about elephants, and about the strange world of the Victorian explorer. We really appreciated it.
Thank you, Alex. And thank you, Lucy. It was a great pleasure.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Boyd Tonkin and Barnaby Phillips.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Lucy Ditchmont.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.